Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is I Love Gay People, A Critique of Allyship, presented by the LGBT Resource Center. And I'd like to turn the time over to today's moderator, Sandra Stokes, who is the Executive Director of the Inclusion Center for Community Justice. Sandra will go ahead and introduce today's panel.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Sandra.
Just with that good morning, it felt like there were like six people in the room. And I was, no, we're rolling a little deeper than that, just want to say. I get the opportunity to introduce today's panelists. Thank you all for joining us and agreeing to help us in this conversation and participate. The questions that I have for you hopefully will bring up some enrichment to the idea of an ally, maybe also clarify some of the issues, what it means when it comes to being an ally, more importantly, to give us an opportunity to understand the importance of critique and being an ally. Those are things that aren't always welcomed. Sometimes it's talking about folks just wanting to show up and do good, but sometimes to do good means we also have to understand how we can do better. So first, let me introduce our panelists today, and I want you to know that their bios are awesome. So first, we have Allison Boyer. Allison is a fourth-year student graduating this spring with a BS in the Environmental and Sustainable Studies. They identify as queer and queer gender. Gender queer.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want.
Okay. Everybody heard that. Okay. Then we have Breanne Blanchard. Breanne works at the LGBT Resource Center as a secretary. Breanne has a BSW, rejoined the LGBT Resource Center as staff in 2013 as the executive secretary after previously working as a student staff member from 2011 to 2012. Bree is a proud graduate of the University of Utah, a gender studies minor, and Bree has a passion for social justice and community building activism. She is a trans feminist, a parent, a partner. Bree grew up in Utah County and still has family there. Welcome, Bree. And last but not least, we have Geeta Mejorta. Pretty close, thank you. Geeta is an assistant professor in the College of Social Work here at the University of Utah. She has over a decade of experience working within the field of domestic violence and community building with queer people of color. Her research and teaching interests are centered on the intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality, and promoting the safety and self-determination of women and queer people of color. Also, welcome Geeta and today's panelist.
Thanks.
Well, as we go throughout our time today, as I mentioned earlier, we have some cards passed out for you all to write down a question if you're not comfortable speaking on the microphone. We will dedicate the last 10 minutes of the conversation for question and answer. I would like to open up the idea of if for any reason your question does not get answered, if folks do have the time to stay behind for conversation, those who can be available will, so we can continue this dialogue. But I also like to remind everyone that the dialogue around being an ally and the importance of critiquing while being an ally does not have to stop when we leave this room. Being an ally is a process. It is not a moment. It is not a phase. It is something that is a daily work, and we all can say, hey, there's work to do. So if you have a moment today where maybe you become uncomfortable or a response or a question makes you shift a little bit and maybe perk up and say, I don't know if I like that response. I don't know if I agree with that answer, or I'm uncomfortable with that question. I would ask you to do some self-work and ask why. Sometimes the root of the question why am I uncomfortable, why was this awkward for me, allows some self-learning to occur as well. But again, these conversations can go into any space where we can be open to them and be open to the idea of being an ally as a process. So with that said, I would like to just dive in to our first question. What are some of the responsibilities of being an ally from your perspective or experience? And I'm going to bounce around a little bit back and forth with the response. So if that's okay, I'd like to start with Geeta. From your perspective, what are the responsibilities of being an ally?
Mm-hmm. It's a hard question because I think in a lot of ways we think about ally as being like an identity. And I think there's some usefulness in shifting it to being a verb, like as opposed to seeing it as just a fixed thing. I see it a lot as being when a person from a group that has privilege really is committed to the liberation of a group that does not. And I think importantly that attitude is carried through the work by centering the people most affected by the social problem that you're trying to work on. And I think one of the responsibilities is maintaining the centeredness of people who are most affected by problems as being the expert on their experience and as being capable of empowering themselves toward their own liberation as opposed to needing to be saved by allies. I think the other thing that I would add is that I think a responsibility of allies is to do work with people who are also part of privilege group, your same privilege group. So doing work with other allies need to do work with other allies, not just with people who are experiencing oppression. And I think that's a really important role for allies that often gets forgotten or not talked about as much.
Thank you. All right, we'll just go down the line. Brief.
Yeah, so I would echo everything Geeta said. I, too, believe that it's problematic when we use ally as a noun or as a title, and definitely reframing it as a verb would help. I think the reason why that makes sense for me is that really it is something that we should all be doing. So framing it as advocacy or work or solidarity and it can be a transient thing as we learn and grow. Sometimes we are, and sometimes we slip up, and so I know for me, every time I hear somebody use ally as a self-title, or it instantly makes me cynical or suspicious. So when somebody has to identify themselves as an ally, I can't help it. My initial reaction is to kind of be like, oh, we'll see about that. Can you listen? Can you take time to not talk and hear feedback and hear what that would actually look like for me? Too often people say come from a place of allyship and then don't really handle that feedback. This happened on a public stage with Janet Mock and Piers Morgan on Piers Morgan Live, where she had some very valid critiques about the way he was framing her trans experience. There was a subscript at the bottom of the screen saying, born a boy and became a woman, and using words and talking about her narrative without her consent in a way that she would never talk about it herself. And when she called him on it, he had the gall to kind of get very defensive and say, you know, why am I the enemy? There are real people out there that are transphobic. So sometimes when we critique allyship and talk about what could be happening better, that listening, doing it as a verb, not as an identity, that definitely happens.
Well, I mean, y'all are great. You basically just said all my feelings. I don't know. I don't really like the word ally. I'm a lot like Brie. When someone says it, it's like immediately like, yeah, like we'll see about that kind of thing. And it's definitely a word that I've met a lot in my life with different individuals claiming it. And then, you know, like claiming it to me, like saying, you know, the title of this panel, I love gay people. But then, like, turning around and saying something super homophobic. And so I think being an ally, I don't really like. I like the word being an advocate more, practicing advocacy. And just, like, constantly pushing back against your privilege and against people outside of, you know, the group. And, like, making, I don't know how to, like, describe what I'm saying. But, you know, like, pushing back, I think, is something that is so important. And not sitting in something that's really, like, problematic, and like confronting that and sitting in this like uncomfortable situation with that person and just being there. I think that's one of my best advice, I guess, for being an advocate.
Great. Just wanted to share with you all, joining us is Dr. Brian K. Hotchkins. Thank you and welcome. Dr. Hotchkins is a postdoctoral research associate in the Masters of Public Administration Department here at the University of Utah. He teaches the PADMN, or P-A-D-M-N, 6965, and he also teaches about social justice, leadership, and policies in the public administration course. His research agenda concerns how students of color across the middle school to graduate continuum utilize leadership experiences to aid their navigation of student organizations at predominantly white high schools and college institutions specifically how students of color have to negotiate their race, gender, and sexual orientation as leaders in an effort to explore varied ways of achieving cultural fit or on a particular campus that they may be a part of. Furthermore, this agenda that he has is designed to educate student affairs practitioners about the needs of students of color who will participate in leadership roles within an academic setting. Dr. Hotchkins is an alumnus of University of Oklahoma and Southern Methodist University. He has recently defended his dissertation at the University of Utah's Education, Leadership, and Policy Department. So, welcome, Dr. Hotchkins.
Thank you.
We were asking the question, what are some of the responsibilities of being an ally? Would you like to add to what was shared earlier?
Okay. can anybody hear me? Okay. So there are two levels, right, to allyship. And even though I am not necessarily a proponent of the term ally, I think the first level is one that is about self-interrogation, right? And so I have to, in order for me to even be able to move towards a space of being called an ally by the group that I claim to represent, I have to first interrogate my implicit bias, my explicit bias, right? And so I have to be able to say, this is who I am. This is what I don't like about certain groups of people for whatever reasons, whether I interacted personally or I was conditioned or socialized to believe or see these groups in a deficit perspective. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is, once you've done that, then it becomes about acting as an ally, for lack of a better term, in the dominant group that is oppressive to which you belong. And so if I am claiming to be I'm for female rights, I have to be able, and I have to realize that the best I can be is an anti-sexist sexist. That's all I'm going to be. That's what I can hope to be. And so I have to be in spaces where men are telling them why maleness subjugates womanhood, right? And so once I've done that work in that circle of oppression, the one that I benefit from as a man in the example, then I can hope to one day move towards a space where I, A, ask permission from women, because they may not need my help. So I can't say, hey, I'm a man, I need to help with the situation. They may not want me in the space or need my help. So I have to ask for permission to be in that space. And if they let me in that space, based on the work that they've seen me do over an extended period of time, if they classify me as an ally, then, hey, I can accept that, but I would still caution in going out saying, hey, I'm an ally. Yeah, in short.
Thank you. So some of the themes that I was able to connect together as you all were discussing was having some intention when showing up and knowing that you want to do an ally piece or be an ally. The other part was doing a lot of your own self-work, so education of oneself, education of the issue that you are going to help or maybe even look into. Sometimes we cannot help until we actually understand what actually is going on, and asking permission from the folks or the marginalized persons that we are going to work with. Permission, I think, is a big step, because it also gives a chance for that group to share how and what capacity they could possibly benefit from having you participate in their movement, project, or moment. So I think those are some themes that I'm beginning to see permeate also within academic writing and critiques of being intentional or being an ally when we're showing up to support. So I would just like to move into, since we talked about kind of those themes that come out of being responsible, which are, if that responsibility is not taken at first or throughout the process, can allies do more harm than good? I'd just like to throw it out there because I think that's kind of the conversation and the topic that gets danced around. Sometimes, what is the harm that can be done? Or we show up with good intentions, and all of a sudden it blows up. I'm like, wait, that did not go down the way it was supposed to, or that did not occur or play out the way I thought it would. So I'm just going to reverse it and just go Allison and down the line. Okay,
cool. Yeah, allies can do a lot of harm. Macklemore is not my theme song. Lady Gaga's not my queen, that's for damn sure. I'm sorry. I apologize to the listening audience. But Macklemore is a prime example for me of why being an ally can be very harmful in certain situations. And that's just because he, in my opinion, is like taking this movement that he's not a part of, and he's perpetrating a lot of really harmful stereotypes through this song, Same Love. That's the song I'm talking about, if you don't know it. And just like while he's trying to be an ally, while he's trying to help this movement move forward, I think he is at the same time pushing a lot of people back and excluding a lot of people and also profiting off of the marginalization of the queer community and not realizing that he's doing a lot of really harmful things and pushing, you know, like, just totally silencing a lot of people. So I think totally allies can do a lot more harm than good. And I'm not saying that, like, if you mess up once, that's it, you're out of my life. I think being an ally is a continuous work, and I'm going to muck up every single day. I'm probably going to offend someone here today. I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it right now. But, like, part of that is just working on myself and realizing that, like, yeah, I messed up, and, like, that's okay, and I'm going to continue to work, and I'm going to continue to push back on what I think. And I think that a lot of allies in my life have not taken that step and don't want to take that step of being self-critical and continuing that work and realizing when they're wrong. So that's kind of my answer.
So in order to answer that question for me, I want to self-reflect a little bit. And in order to do that, I want to really quickly clarify one of the other limitations of using ally as an identity is we've come to use it as a shorthand for assuming cishet identity, so someone who's not transgender and is straight. And so it gets used sometimes in other communities, but as a shorthand, when somebody says, I'm an ally, a lot of times it gets used that way in our community. And one of the problems with that is that it denies our intersectionality, meaning that all of us have areas of privilege and marginalization. And so for any person in this LGBTQIA or queer community, there's lots of privilege and also a lot of marginalization, right? And so part of what we need to do in critiquing that allyship is pulling it apart of who gets to call themselves ally, but who is doing advocacy work. And the answer to that should hopefully be all of us, myself included. So I just wanted to clarify that. So for me, thinking about that, can an ally do more harm than good? I want to self-reflect on my own advocacy work and places in which I might have been framed as an ally. And I would definitely say yes, right? So all of us have been that person. I hope we can all answer truthfully on that. Where we think we're doing good work, but we're completely ill-informed. And so starting with myself, I would say I do that all the time. I try to gather the best information I can. I try to inform myself. I educate myself. I surround myself with people that have had a diverse array of experiences and intersectionalities, and we talk all the time because I'm a talker. And I think I know a topic or I know something, but when I slip up and I start speaking for somebody instead of with somebody, that is when I'm doing more harm than good in my experience. And so for me, when I start saying, well, you know, for gay men, this is kind of the things that they're going through, instead of saying, you know, for me, as a queer woman, I don't really know all that a gay man might go through. But these are some of the things that I've found intersecting with my experience. Or here's some really good resources, or here's some people that I can bring to that conversation. I think that's when we're doing the most harm.
I agree with everything that's already been said. I think absolutely allies can do more harm than good. And I think one is, I mean, speaking to what was said earlier about the importance of self-interrogation, I think not having self-awareness about who you are, about the areas where you have privilege, about the areas and experience that you have of oppression can be really destructive. I think that also going back to what I said previously, just centering yourself. And I think that this is a real danger with allyship, is that often we become engaged with ally work because we want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel like we're contributing to good work. And we might have real feelings about the injustice that we see, but often in that we can really be prioritizing our own need to feel better or to feel good or to feel that we're doing something, which is not actually about the empowerment of people who are most affected. I also think that another danger is people, I mean, this goes back to the asking permission piece, is I think you can do more harm than good when you assume that everybody in a particular group that you're doing allyship with or for has the same view of an issue. And I've seen this play out in destructive ways where I might have a position on an issue and somebody who is an ally will go to another member of my community and say, well, what do you think? And then pit us against each other. I've seen it like multiple. I mean, I'm sure all of us have probably seen versions of that. And so I think really understanding that if you are trying to ally around a particular issue or a particular community, that you need to understand the complexity of that community or that issue, and that it's not going to be just one monolithic thing, that if you talk to one representative from that group, that you now are down and you get it and you know where to go.
And so my initial response as an answer would be yes. And so, but it's convoluted, right? And so you have, so there's in-group and out-group work that's occurring, right? And so when I talk about interrogating self, for instance, there are, if we just go with three identities, so we all have a multitude of identities. So if we just look at our gender, our race, and our sexual orientation, right? So I've met, because we exist in different spaces, sometimes we are representative of positive things in one space and negative things in another, right? And so I know gay white males who, in certain spaces, are the most racist person in the room. And so even though they are advocating for the rights of their gay identity, their white identity is negative, right? And so what happens is I may see you in one space. If I'm in a space that is a LGBTQ event, you are advocating vehemently for equal rights on a multitude of levels, right? But then I hear you in another space that you don't know I'm listening. I have colleagues and friends that hear you being racist in another space. And so that's, A, I don't understand how that's possible, but B, it is because of people representing their different identities differently, it becomes a situation where I can support you in a gay rights struggle, but resent you and want you removed from the space as it relates to a racial struggle, right? And so you just, when I say interrogation of self, speaking to those in your oppressive group that you belong to, by the time you are people in the group that you say you are representative of, by the time they call you an ally, you've probably been vetted for years. So the likelihood of you making errors or mistakes decreases with the length of time that you are identified by that group as an ally.
Mm. So I, seeing from the responses and hearing as well, that as we talk about being an ally and allyship, it's complex. It's really connected to the intersectionality of discrimination and marginalized communities. And so to do work in one area, what I'm hearing is always not enough. It's to do self-work first. Work on oneself, become aware, possibly of where your biases or work, that's what we like to call it, the work, needs to be done. But more importantly, to acknowledge where the work is being done. And if you are in those spaces, not just during allyship, but even in your authentic time, your relaxation spaces, because I also understand in some movements, there's the need for a common understanding of the language that this group, project, or moment would like to use. Messaging is big. And also, there's the work that needs to be done to show an authentic interest, a genuine interest of wanting to support, but also wanting to learn. And then the last leg, which is not always the last, but the last leg itself is also understanding that just because I may be doing my work in one area does not give me the time to not have to examine and look at myself in another social context or within a different identity that I may have. So moving that into the benefits, What are some of the benefits of having the support of allies that are doing their work? And this time I'm going to start with Bree.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
So the benefit of having allies that are doing their work.
Yes. Right?
So assuming somebody is doing real work and advocacy within themselves and interrogating their own identities, as we've talked about, and isn't self-proclaiming their allyship, assuming all of those things first, I think there is some real benefits. So I've done a lot of trainings over the years, cultural competency trainings, talking a lot about intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I bring up examples of family members. So for me, I first started coming out to my mom, you know, almost a decade ago now. And we move in very different circles. So my mom is straight and LDS and lives in more rural Utah. And we have very different circles of friends. We have very different social cultures. And we talk about queerness and queer identity and politics and really any social justice issue using probably very different words. And I think sometimes we can be so nervous about saying the right thing that we don't say anything and we don't do anything. And I hope I'm not alone. I'm speaking for myself. That's not what I'm advocating for right now. It's to think critically, not to do nothing. So I think of my mom, and I think she has access to people I will never meet. And she has access to conversations that I will never be a part of and will never be invited to. And while she might speak about these issues in a way that I wouldn't, you know, she will speak from her own experience. And so I trust my mom after all of these years to speak authentically from her own self. And there is nothing more wonderful to me than hearing my mom, who, you know, is in a very different culture, to talk about her queer daughter. You know, there's something about that. Somebody of another generation, just using the word queer, first of all, is just kind of cute. And But she speaks about her experience as a parent, and that's the first thing she's getting right. So we talk about working within our circles of privilege and doing that separate work. I really appreciate it when somebody who's doing this work speaks from their experience and not mine. So she says, well, as a parent of a queer daughter, da-da-da-da-da, she gets to have these imperfect conversations just like I get to have all these imperfect conversations with completely different people. Either because I'm afraid or intimidated of that space, or they're afraid or intimidated of me, or, you know, sometimes it's discrimination, right? So I think that's some of the real positive things that can happen when we do advocacy right and don't call ourselves allies, end of story, full stop, right?
Geeta, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Building off what Bree's already said, I think that access to people in power is something that often allies have that people who are part of marginalized groups might not have in the same way. Also, the way that messages are heard, depending on who you are in the world, differs. If I go to the president of the university and have a conversation about diversity and social justice on this campus, I'm going to be heard in a particular way as a queer woman of color, as an assistant professor, as somebody who's not from here, etc., whereas an older white male might have a very different reception talking about very similar issues, right, just because of who that person is and how they're going to be heard and seen. The other thing about sort of a benefit of allyship is going back to the idea of intersectionality. I think my mic isn't really working so well.
Okay.
Yeah, we're hearing you.
Okay. Is going back to that idea of intersectionality. So I think it's like we can be allies in one space and we're going to need allies in another. And I think there's something really important in thinking about a bigger vision of social justice that is about linking our struggles, right? And also linking our empowerment and understanding the ways that different systems of oppression are really reliant on one another and they do intersect and they're interdependent. And so we need people to be working on all of them from their different positionalities. And I think that's where we have the most power. And I guess the last thing that I'll say is just on a personal level, it's meaningful when you are in a struggle or when you are part of marginalized groups to know that there are people who have your back. I mean, it's kind of that simple on like a human level. Like, it means something, and it makes a difference in how I experience my day-to-day in the world. And I mean, that kind of sounds cheesy, but it matters on that level, and I just feel like it's worth saying that.
Anyone else have something they'd like to add?
Well, just briefly. So public displays of allyship or advocacy give me pause, right? And so as a professor, I am learning, because I have a perceived notion of power attached to my title on campus, which may not be true, that I have, my praxis points deal with research, opportunity, scholarship, internship. At the end of the day, you can talk all you want. I don't do a lot of talking. I do a lot of action. And so what is your praxis point, right? So a lot of times it is about students not having access to resources because they don't even know they exist. And so there are pockets of knowledge on campus that some of you will never have access to because you don't know someone who knows about that, about those resources, right? And so for me, it is about being purposeful and strategic in guiding students through their persistence towards graduation, through graduate school, towards law school, or finishing a PhD. And so ultimately, I believe being a good ally or advocate is about gathering and distributing resources. And so I can be a champion for you verbally. I can defend you when someone tells a joke. That's not acceptable. And that's, I have some white colleagues who have done that, who have interrupted ignorance, and I appreciate that. But ultimately, how are you helping that group have a greater social mobility at the end of the day? For me, that's what matters.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I just wanted to say, like, I really appreciate y'all being up here. I learn so much every time I talk with any of these people, and I'm swooning so hard. So they've said all my words.
Great. So the importance of being a healthy ally, a healthy community member, looking at one's well-being, but also, more importantly, the well-being of the marginalized group that you're working with, what resources are around you that you have access to, how do you connect the group that you are working with to those resources? More importantly, how do you yourself walk the talk, in a way? I always say that, you know, it's that old adage, can you talk the talk, can you walk the walk? And I always like to add that being an ally or being involved in advocacy is not always fluffy. Sometimes it's sitting in the funk and dealing with the emotions and the hardship that the group that you are working with, if you are a member of that group or not, it means that you're there because something compelled you, something did not feel right, and you felt like you wanted to do something and didn't know where to start sometimes. And showing up is half the work, sitting in the work is the other end of it. And that is uncomfortable. It's not always warm smiles, hugs, and glitter bombs. It's, you know, sometimes sitting around and talking about, and more importantly, listening to folks. If they feel safe with you, with the group that they're in, share their experiences. Because being in a marginalized community and being marginalized on different or multiple points of your identity hurts. And so if we talk about having a healthy community, having a healthy ally, it's reaffirming, it's validating, and it also can be purposeful so that folks understand that this work cannot be done alone, and this work is not meant for one group to do alone all the time. That sometimes we have to give members of a group a break and sometimes go out on the front lines, per se, or be the advocate who can interrupt something, an act of discrimination, whether it's verbal or emotional maybe happening at the moment or physical at the time. So with that, talking about, you know, sitting in it, why is critique important? Not just purposeful, but why is it important within advocacy and allying? Why? What's its meaning for you? Why is critique necessary? And this time I'm going to start with Brian, if that's all right, and then come back down.
So self-critique, in my mind, is the most important thing, right? So I have to learn, it is a skill to absorb and redirect or deflect anger from people that are in the group that your identity oppresses, right? So sometimes I have discussions with my feminist friends and colleagues about anger that is real to them, that may have absolutely nothing to do with me, right? Sometimes that anger has everything to do with me. And so being defensive is not an option for me. Because even if the interpretation of what happened was, I interpreted it as different than they did, their anger towards me is valid. And so we need to work through that. If I care enough about that person to work through it, then we'll work through it. Now, there are other people that I don't have a rapport with, right? And so sometimes you have to also say, how much energy am I going to give today to deal with this situation? That may have nothing to do with me. Because a lot of people will isolate and target because they are aware of your identities and come to you with a lot of stuff that's not relevant to you. It's relevant to them, but it has nothing to deal with you directly, right? And so it is okay to first and foremost be able to critique yourself, but also, so that's a multi-directional relationship too. Because race is most salient to me, there are times when I have discussions with white colleagues about issues, and I have to be open to their critique of my perspective too, right? And so because there are some times when I get emotional about race because it's serious, right? There's years of data that says racism is problematic for people of color. And so sometimes I internalize that, right? But I can't, even in my anger, I can be intellectual in my anger, but I would discourage you from lashing out against people who you have relationships with that you value. So be critical of yourself, but also allow people to be critical of you when you have, whether your identity oppresses or is oppressed, it is a multidirectional relationship. So be as eager to be critiqued as you are as to critique others.
It's a two-way street. And then I'll loop around. Allison, you have something you'd like to add?
Oh, yeah. Could you repeat the question?
I sure can.
Yeah, thank you.
You got it. So why is critique important when looking at allyship or advocacy work?
Yeah. I think Brian, really hit the nail on the head right there. I think being critical of where we're coming from as allies and as advocates, because I don't claim allyship to many communities. I'm still doing a lot of work. And I think, not getting comfortable in an identity of being, or in the act of being an ally, as we were saying, changing it to a verb, I think getting too comfortable in that act just doesn't allow people to open up to see what is going on in that moment. And, there's a lot of little things that happen. Microaggressions are a real thing that happen every single day on this campus and happen every single day off campus and in all our own lives, within interpersonal relationships, on TV, everything. And if I become too comfortable in my advocacy, in my allyship, then I'm not doing the right work and I'm not doing this community justice. And so I think being critical of where I am and where other people are is so important because I'm never comfortable, and that's unfortunate. And I don't want anyone to feel too comfortable with how I identify.
Yeah. So for me, I think. So I want to talk a little bit about it specifically within a context of academia for a second, because I experience. It's a very uncomfortable experience sometimes to be a trans queer woman in academia, where people often have read articles and can use words and do these verbal gymnastics with you in their advocacy work, but they don't have as much heart in it, right? And so sometimes I feel this divide from my trans family outside of academia. Sometimes it can be a little bit of an isolating experience, as I often meet people who are very adept at saying some of the right things and using some of the right words, self-care. I'm trying to think of some of the other buzzwords, but, advocacy. I mean, just any of these words we're using right now, knowing that you've read an article in a gender studies class or a critical race theory class or whatever that is different than understanding how little you know. And I think of my own development as an activist and advocate and just my own personal identities and struggles. It's been a really important development for me to get really, really used to understanding mistakes and thinking hard and critical. So I think that is at the heart of any of this work. If it's to be meaningful, we have to get used to shutting up and listening and saying sorry and doing better. I'm really happy that I'm in an environment right now with family given and chosen, and a work environment where that's a daily or a weekly practice. I mean, I think of how many staff meetings we have every week where we just talk about, like, and this came up, and we screwed up, and it's a really uncomfortable feeling. But I think it's fundamental to this work is getting used to being embarrassed and working through that embarrassment and doing better and coming up with real concrete ways to include people who have been marginalized by your work. Even with the best of intentions. Intentions are nice and all, but they don't always translate. So,
thank you.
Again, I would agree with a lot of what's already been said. I think that it's important to critique, one, so that we don't get complacent, so that we don't get comfortable, as Allison was saying, with our role, with who we are, that we are in a constant process of that kind of critical self-reflection and also reflection on how we're engaging with the work that we're doing. I also think it's important to be critical of our intention. So I really like what you were saying, Bree, about, you know, intentions are great and everything, but it's also really important to always be mindful of impact, right? So intention and impact don't always match. And I think we often get really caught up in our good intention, but we have to always also be willing to look at what are the kind of short and long-term impacts of our work or our role. I think the other thing I would want to offer about critique is that I also think it's important not to get caught up in endless critique to the point of paralysis. Just speaking to the academic kind of, you know, thing is that I think we can go there, right? I mean, we can get to this place where we are so self-critical and so critical of others that we foreclose the possibility of connection and we foreclose the possibility of doing work and moving forward. And I think that that's a dangerous place that critique can take us. So I think that it's finding a balance, and I think it's also about continuing to imagine and reimagine new possibilities at the same time that we are critiquing and deconstructing. And I think sometimes we can get real stuck in the critiquing and deconstructing. We feel like if we can't do it perfectly, we can't do it at all. And I think that is a really problematic place. And so I think some of our work is about also the reconstruction and creativity and building possibility of how to do the work that we're doing as much as it is about critique.
Thank you. And I also like to add that what I hear you talking about is there's a culture that starts to come out of individual culture within advocacy, which is, what is my style? What am I good at? Where am I struggling? You know, how do I function well? What is my accountability to myself? What's the accountability to the group that I'm working with? I also like to look at it as, how do I not shy away from being critiqued, but how do I warm up to the idea of critique? Because I think critique is a word that's been stigmatized. We hear, you know, critique, and usually comes in with, well, there's going to be some defensiveness associated with it. And so a lot of the times it's looking at, how do I check in? How do I check in with the group and let the group check in with me? Sometimes I know changing word association is a big deal, but folks have a real visceral response to the word critique, especially if we look at what you all talked about, which is when the theories that we have learned, the theory we have read about, then we go to practice it, and that's when it blows up. We're like, that did not happen the way the book or the chapter said, or I did not, you know, take into account that this could have been an element. So when we start to practice the theory, when we educate ourselves and then we begin to practice that community building, that's where the check-in becomes necessary, because then that's also how we know maybe the literature we had wasn't, you know, on point. Maybe the literature we had access to at the time was not relevant to this moment in this movement. So that's why I say it's an ongoing process. And I hear you all, you know, speaking to that, looking at how do we keep it ongoing so we do not become so pragmatic in our criticism that we no longer do anything. So moving, keeping things moving, because we've talked about critique, I'd like to ask you personally, and for what you use, so, you know, the I statements in this one, how do you apply your advocacy, or how do you apply your work when you're going to look at taking some steps? So if you were to give advice to someone, you're going to give advice to me, you know, what are some steps you would suggest I could take to continue or begin to be more intentional with my process as an ally. And when anybody can take it, if you feel prepared. What would be your advice?
All right. Well, Sandra, let me give you some advice. I think there's a really good article I read by Black Girl Dangerous, Mia McKenzie, who wrote about four ways to push back on your privilege. And I keep those in mind all the time. And I'm getting really nervous right now, so I can't remember all four of them, but search it.
It's really good.
One of my favorites, though, is just stepping down. And if they're, like, she uses a really good example. If there's, like, a conference that I really want to go to, but they don't have wheelchair access, then what am I saying by going to that conference? And what am I saying by attending that conference? Am I now okay with the fact that this is, like, an ableist situation, like, a very problematic situation? So I think me, myself, and, like, what I would say to, like, if you want to work on allyship or advocacy is just stepping back, stepping down, allowing for spaces to be filled with people who maybe don't usually get a voice, or maybe don't usually have the opportunity to be in that space, or pushing back on organizations and stepping down and just being very intentional and critical of organizations and programs, because a lot of these things, you know, we don't think about. And me, as, like, an able-bodied person, sometimes I don't think about, like, wheelchair access, and sometimes I don't think about, you know, the speakers at a conference and how that may affect some certain people. So just stepping back and, like, allowing that space to build and to improve. That's my advice.
It's interesting. I have such a reaction to the idea of having to give advice, and I think part of it is that I don't want to send everybody away with, like, a checklist of, like, here's the five things that I need to do to be a good ally, and you said that on the panel, so I'm doing it now, and, you know, I kind of don't want to feed into that, so I feel very, like, cautious.
That's honest.
But, I mean, I think a lot of things, actually, that have already been said. I think one is absolutely knowing yourself, understanding your own social positionality, who you are, where are the places where you do have privilege, where are the places that you don't, what are the biases that you have, what are the biases that you need to work through, what is your community, what are the ideas and values that your community, the communities that you're in, support or believe about different groups of people. I mean, just I think really unpacking your own self and your own stuff is really critical. I think educating yourself about issues that you want to be doing advocacy around and taking that responsibility on for yourself, not expecting people and groups that are most affected to do that work for you. Especially now in this day and age of the internet, it is that we have so much access to information, so doing that work. I think another thing is relationship building. I mean, we haven't talked about that a lot, but I just see that as such a critical component of allyship is building relationships, building coalition across identities, getting to know organizations that are doing work in these areas already. I think also really having some humility about that and understanding that there's a lot of work that's been going on forever, for hundreds and hundreds of years, lots of work around resistance and empowerment, and that you're not, you know, just like the first person to think about this idea and to decide you want to do something about it. So really kind of understanding some of the historical context and building that kind of trust and relationship with work that's happening. I think lastly is just really knowing when to step up and when to step back. And that's an ongoing process, and some of that does happen through that process of checking in and being accountable. And it might look different at different moments within a project or within a particular effort or organization. But, you know, having some thoughtfulness about when and how you do take leadership and what it means and looks like for you to step back and allow others to take leadership, particularly others who are most affected by the issue or project that you're working on.
Anyone else have something different to add?
Did you?
I'll let
you. I think for me, I'm trying to think of what is working so much better right now than, say, even 5 or 10 years ago for me personally in my advocacy. And I think one is, like, it's really important to have a support system. And that's people that aren't going to be triggered or microaggressed by your processing and needing to process your privilege. it's really been, I think that can be a real game changer. I also just echo with what Gita said as far as the replacing one checklist that we're going to critique to death with a new one. I mean, I totally get that. These are just general ideas. So support structure, making sure that you have people. Because if you're doing advocacy well, it's supposed to be exhausting. It's supposed to break you to pieces and make you have to put it back together again. You're going to need help to do that. Also, I think getting away from this, I call it the gotcha game, but like sometimes, especially getting back to academia, we read a couple articles and we're more invested in being less wrong than the other person than we are about being right. So we say, oh, I read this article and that's why you're problematic. And then you walk away, drop mic, right? So, and it gets kind of, instead of looking at what we are actually doing. So getting away from that is a really important part. A really important step, and it makes us listen, and it makes us learn, and then we're running low on time, so I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
So first thing, Google the term intersectionality. Second thing, once you do, you realize that some of your identities are oppressive, and some of them are being oppressed simultaneously, right? For those identities that are oppressive, I think you need to learn how to become vulnerable. When people come to you and say, you did this to me, again, be vulnerable, open, and listen to what they have to say. Don't process it right then, because you'll react instead of respond. Mm-hmm. So be vulnerable. But as it relates to your identities that are being oppressed, you need to get to a space where you can be confrontational. And so I ain't giving anybody passes. I hear you say something foul, I'm getting at you. And it's not about me physically accosting you, right? But it is about me intellectually accosting you. And so get to the point where you can be confrontational. Because if they say something wrong or do something wrong and you allow them to leave that space, they're going to do it again somewhere else. It'll be your fault because you didn't say anything. But the third thing is you have to measure your emotional costs, right? And so I think it'll be rare that someone physically accosts you. But emotionally, there's a cumulative effect of dealing with ignorance on a daily level. And so as a professor, when students come to my class, I deal with their ignorance a little different, right? Because my students are 18 to 22 for the most part. Some of them have not ever had an African-American male professor. So they don't have a template for intellectual prowess, right? So they don't know that I got 35 other African-American male professors' numbers in my phone. So to me, it's normal. To them, I'm the magical unicorn, right? And so you have to be able to deal with the cumulative effect of emotional cost, because there is an emotional cost that you will pay. And you'll find yourself crying for nothing or being emotional for what you interpret as nothing, but it is connected to something that you experienced or someone that you love experienced. And so just don't allow the subtleties of your body responding negatively to go uninvestigated. Talk to somebody about that, about things that are happening to you that you're not used to, and be interrogated again. Interrogating that emotional cost will often lead you back to something that, where you were injured emotionally and you weren't even aware of it, and 6 months later, it manifests itself.
Thank you. Thank you all for your comments. And the reason I asked that question is because it's hard. There's not a toolkit for this. There's just some guidance. Here's some things that I see work for me. I think I say that because we have a lot of young folks in our lives, and our young folks are growing up, and we also have our people that we love in our lives. And how do we give, feedback and share? This is what I've seen work for me, and this is what I've seen not work. Because when folks say they, want to do some advocacy work, sometimes they might come to you and say, "This is my approach. What do you think?" If they trust you, they're going to come and ask. So that's why I would say, ahead of time, what can we throw out there? We have about 2 minutes left on air. So we are going to start some of the questions. So we may not get all of them on air. But again, if you can stay, we can get to them. If everybody has about 10 minutes to stay behind to get through some of those questions. But hopefully today you had an opportunity to have an aha moment, like, oh, I didn't think of that, or I've never heard it articulated that way. Thank you to our panelists for sharing and putting yourselves out there. More importantly, I know it kind of feels like a hot seat sometimes, because there's this little power feeling like folks are going to take my word and it's going to get construed. But more importantly, the conversation has to be had. So with Ally Week and the LGBT Resource Center heading things up, I appreciate, the the opportunity to have this conversation on what it means to be an ally, what it means to be intentional and to be a part of a process and to authentically engage in marginalized communities and create access through sharing personal privilege, or more importantly, sometimes just showing up and cleaning toilets. That's part of advocacy too. Sometimes you got to stay behind and do the grunt work to keep things moving on the back end. Those are just as important as standing in the front end and interrupting a moment. So thank you all. Hopefully you can attend the rest of the activities throughout the week. But if you have your question cards, if you can pass them up, we will begin to go through those. But if anybody has a question per se, there is also a microphone towards the front if anybody would like to come up and ask that question at this moment.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah, and so Emily, please ask that you please raise your cards up so she can come and grab them to get to your question. But thank you to the Hinckley Institute for hosting us and having this opportunity, allowing us to have this moment. So we'll go into the questions now.
I think this gentleman has a question.
Yep.
If you want to.
Coming from a predominantly, you know, LDS culture here in Utah, I like to think of myself as a lover, not a fighter. I'm a straight, sexual-oriented person, so I like to be very open. Doctor, you talked about social mobility as one of the goals, as being a good advocate. What are some of the long-term goals that we should be looking forward to or working towards as allies, being a good ally, if you will?
You asking me that question?
That's for everybody.
Oh, okay.
I think it's totally depends on the community, because, I mean, like we've been saying throughout this whole entire panel, there's millions of communities you can be an ally or an advocate for. For me, the gay rights movement is not my end goal. It's never been my goal. A gay marriage is not something that's important to me. Don't like take that and be like, I heard a gay person say this one time, please. But you know, it's like, I think there's not really an end goal, because we will never live in a post-racial, post-sexist, post-heterosexist society. There's always going to be work to be done. And so I don't think that there is, like, I mean, there's like an ideal, but I'm not ever sure if we're ever going to reach that, because I'm very pragmatic, though.
Do you need to leave early? Do you want to go?
No.
No?
Okay. I mean, I do need to leave early, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I think two things, right? So, yeah, I would echo in your question what I heard was like, okay, so where are we headed? Like, I get the critique, where are we headed? I do want to echo that hopefully where we're headed is not a finite endpoint. I know that's horrible. We live in a postmodern world, especially in academia, where like, oh, you know, up is down, left is right. But like, still, I really think that we're not ever finished. I don't see it finished in my lifetime. But that doesn't mean that I can't work with very specific goals in mind so that my kids will grow up in a different world than I have, right? And so for me, I think specifically about some of those goals, they're just endless. I mean, I would love to live in a world where we are responsible about demographics, how we collect them, how we discriminate based on them, and it doesn't matter the demographic. For me, I think discrimination is real. All these isms are real, and they're experienced daily. And so to be able to be responsible about that, I would love to live in a world in which I got to define my own gender and not have it defined by documents that tell me what boxes I have to fit into on any given day. I would love to be able to explore my concept of family and what family structure looks like without it being sanctioned, approved, or disapproved by government authorities. Those are definitely parts of that. I also want to live in a world in which little kids can grow up and not be interrogated and asked to defend things that they're just exploring and figuring out. So I look at my brilliant children, and I'm their mom, so I can think they're brilliant. One is 10 and one is 6, and they are light years ahead of some of the adults I know in their understanding of these identities. And I watch them have to answer adult questions that should be directed at their parents, and they have to daily do that on elementary school playgrounds in our state. And so I would love to live in a world in which people understood the way that they're interacting with each other and the way that they're harmful when they're not intending to be harmful. I would love an end goal to be that we don't take our prejudices out on our children. That would be a really big goal for me. So whether that's us as teachers or us as parents or us as neighbors or family members, that's a really important goal.